Hello and welcome to Rock and Roll Politics, the podcast with me, Steve Richards. Thanks a lot for tuning in from wherever you are. And indeed, judging from some of the questions this week, it's across Europe, United States, Australia, everywhere in the whole world, gathering together to make sense of the crazy world of British politics and sometimes politics from elsewhere too. So this is what we're going to do in our time together, if it's okay with all of you. Shortly, I'm going to be reflecting on the feverish speculation about Rishi Sunak and whether he should be dumped and whether he will be dumped as Prime Minister before the general election, which we now will not be on the same day as the May local elections. We know nothing more than that for sure, but that we do know. And yeah, as ever with all of us lot, we can delve deep on this. We can combine what he has done, his character, and the context in which he has been seeking to lead, to make a judgment on what Tory MPs should do. So hopefully that will provide a different sort of light to shine on the kind of febrile world of the Tory parliamentary party. And then there will be some of your brilliant questions, ranging widely, a lot of responses from our reflection on the role of character last week, as in Keir Starmer, at the discussion with Tom Baldwin, the Starmer biographer now, but on many other themes as well. So we'll try and get through as many as we possibly can. Thank you for sending them in. Just before we get going, a few notices. First of all, thanks all of you who came to the live Rock and Roll Politics show at the Rope Tackle in Shoreham. It was a great evening. I really, really enjoyed it. It was great seeing some of you members of the cooperative at the end as well, including the legendary Denise, whose mother was one of our barometer figures in the cooperative, a Tory voter who was shifting, but where was she shifting to? Who, if you remember from a few podcasts ago, we dedicated the podcast to Denise's mum because she sadly died. But anyway, it was a fantastic night. And then thank you those who came out on a Saturday night when there was a lot of live sport on TV and, of course, you know, clubs to go dancing to and all the rest of it. Thanks to all of those who came to the brilliant York Book Festival at St. Peter's School on Saturday evening. And again, it was really great afterwards. That festival is really terrific. And at the end, you can have a glass of wine while you queue and buy the books. And anyway, there was a really good atmosphere. And again, meeting so many who listened to the podcast was very, very satisfying. And yeah, the next one live is on March the 26th at King's Place. And I have to say, the quality of questions in York and at the Rope Tackle, when we had our question time session as part of the evening, were so good that there's a lot to live up to on March the 26th. And I won't tell you what the predictions were because it might influence things in that evening. You know, when that evening begins on March 26th, what course will it take? What conclusions will we reach? Where will we be by then? Anyway, the tickets for the King's Place show, there aren't many left, are on the King's Place website, and there will be a link with the blurb to this podcast. So, yeah, let's keep getting together and making sense of it all. So, Rishi Sunak. It was very interesting. I got a call from a senior Tory figure with very good contacts across the range of the party. We were actually having a discussion about something else, but he said something very interesting to me, which has really got me thinking. He said, based on discussions with a range of Tory figures, from cabinet ministers to others in the parliamentary party, he thought it was 55 to 45 that they would get rid of Rishi Sunak. And as he put it to me, when there's a choice between death and madness, you choose madness. And the reason it got me thinking even more about this possibility is that I, who kind of am very wary of kind of these speculative reports about the possible fall of a leader, because it really doesn't happen very often. It has in the Tory party in recent years, as has been well chronicled. We've been living through it, but that's very unusual. And with an election looming, it makes it much trickier. But of course, it's because the election is looming that there is mounting panic in the Conservative Party. And last week, during the chaos that erupted on several fronts, I began to wonder if I were a Tory MP, I would not go for madness rather than death. But in order to make that judgment, we need to decide how much lies at the hands of Sunak, how much is an impossible context and an impossible party to lead, what credible options there are in the context of the run-up to an election. And I got a lot of emails about the framing I did in the build-up to the discussion with Tom Baldwin about Keir Starmer. How much does character matter in politics? And I quoted an essay question that we used to kind of discuss endlessly with our English teacher when a few of us were doing. They used to have this thing, I don't know where they do now, called English S level, which was kind of a bit more sophisticated than the A level in terms of the depth of analysis. Like us lot gathering for this podcast compared to other politics podcasts, you know, that kind of thing. Anyway, a lot of people very interested in this because, of course, in the context of our discussions then as kids, character is destiny discussed in the context of Shakespeare's tragedies. And as I kind of argued last week, you can't pluck the character solely out of the context. And it's a brilliant reminder of, in politics, the focus is so much on character, but context matters too. I got the book out, which I read a lot when I was a student, by this guy, A.C. Bradley, who wrote, he did a series of lectures very early on in the 20th century, about 1904. He was a psychoanalyst, and he treated each of Shakespeare's characters almost like they were human beings to analyse. And so it's brilliant. I really recommend it. If you want a compelling read, it reads well to this very day. And it really wants you to read those plays again. And so, for example, he analyses the reasons why Hamlet delayed taking revenge on Claudius, who had killed his father, and the father's ghost had told Hamlet to act against Claudius, and he doesn't, and finds reasons why not to, and so on. But I remember my English teacher saying, well, one of the reasons why Hamlet delays is if he had acted quickly, it would have been a very short play. And so you have to go beyond character. The playwright is God. And then T.S. Eliot, a few years later, wrote a brilliant essay saying one of the flaws of the play is that the external circumstances in Elsinore, where Hamlet is set, doesn't quite justify Hamlet's behaviour. There's a gap between them. I don't think that's right, actually. But again, it's an exploration of circumstance and character. And it's a brilliantly useful way of guiding us towards a judgment on the suitability of a leader. So what has Sunak faced that any leader would have faced, even a genius and someone politically sophisticated? Well, clearly he inherited a party in trauma, a party that has had to rid itself of two prime ministers in the space of a few months, is a deeply, deeply disturbed party. And that was part of his weird inheritance, in which he became prime minister having lost a leadership contest with party members. And of course, he, when he won, did not go back to the party membership. The MPs elected him without that happening. And so he arrived in quite a fragile place, a party all over the place, And it's very traumatic removing leaders, especially when they're prime minister. Not being elected by a party membership who had voted against him just months before. Boris Johnson breathing down his neck, threatening to stand himself in the post-Truss leadership contest. And a party disturbed more fundamentally than that. Johnson had won an election in December 2019, sowing basically a Brexit coalition and presenting a manifesto promising the earth, without going into much detail, how this paradise on earth would be delivered, big spending pledges, tax cuts, everything. And without the scrutiny that Labour is subjected to when it proposes to spend 25 pence on a breakfast club in County Durham. The contrast, the more I think about that 2019 manifesto, and the lack of scrutiny. I know Boris Johnson avoided doing political interviews for that very reason. They were promising the earth. He had no idea how he was going to deliver it and didn't. But the avoidance was one thing. I don't blame him for avoiding interviews. You don't have to do them if you can't answer the questions. But the lack of critical scrutiny, the willing, enthusiastic endorsements of most newspapers, just when you compare it to, as I say, you know, if Labour say, oh yeah, 25p on a breakfast club in County Durham. Oh, what about the black hole this will produce in 2029 and all this kind of stuff? So there was this coalition that would be very hard to keep in place. And you were surrounded by former prime ministers with their followers. And the economy, of course, was on the edge of another cliff, or the same edge that it had been on for a long, long time. And so it was unquestionably a tough inheritance, which would, as I say, have challenged a figure of epic political skill. Nonetheless, since coming to that post, and the more I think about it, the more I think it is unsurprising, he has shown an astonishing lack of political dexterity, a lack of strategic skill, and seems to have advisors who are similarly lacking in the depth required to navigate the Tory party into even a slightly better position. Why is this unsurprising? Because Sunak rose very quickly, and it is only relatively recently the modern British political culture allows figures to rise from nowhere and then become titans. You know, I find it very interesting that Kemi Badenoch is now a possible successor. And be, oh, yeah, Kemi, you know, oh, Kemi this, Kemi that. Well, Kemi's done very little in politics. That's not her fault. She hasn't been in politics very long. And so on. Oh, yeah, Penny Mordaunt has wielded a sword at the coronation. Oh, yeah, she must be prime minister. In the same way that Johnson was selected partly because he had made voters laugh on Have I Got News For You. These shallow reasonings for assuming that people will be epic leaders. And being prime minister is tough, tough, tough. And Sunak's rise was, famously, he was a junior cabinet minister, chief secretary to the Treasury, got promoted to being chancellor because Dominic Cummings, I think, thought he would be more malleable when Number 10 were trying to run things. Almost immediately, the pandemic struck when Sunak was chancellor, and he kind of inherited the furlough system. You know, Number 10 were working on it. The Treasury had been working on it. He is a hard worker and can master detail and mastered the furlough system and presented it. Well, what an easy thing to present. I'm going to give you a lot of money. I'm going to do what it takes to make sure your business survives. I mean, it's not a tricky thing to deliver. He became very popular, as someone would in such a position. And he appeared authoritative compared with the bumbling Johnson, who was wholly inarticulate at those famous pandemic press conferences, hesitant, And there was Sunak basically giving away money and people receiving money, and they could see that they were receiving the money in their pay packets and so on. And he became popular. And from that, his leadership ambitions began to spark. And yet he was never really tested in tough political situations. Of course, the pandemic was tough for everybody. But his role in it was not, actually. And his judgments were poor. He was the one famously pushing for no lockdown in the autumn of 2020. And one of the findings of the inquiry will be how disastrous that was. So when he was called on to make a judgment, he got it wrong. And pretty soon after that, he found himself in number 10. So he was not prepared for the titanic challenges he was facing as an individual, as a human being, which is inevitable when you've been in politics for such a little time, when your constituency, Richmond, is deeply privileged in North Yorkshire. You would have been exposed to very little. Yourself, incredibly famously wealthy. You hang around with Goldman Sachs types and so on. It is a limited but gilded path to the top. And since then, the errors he has made, and you use error very carefully in politics. You know, people say, oh, Blair screwed up and made an error over Iraq. Wasn't it an error? His reading of the situation was one that led to that course. Now, I know why he made that reading. It was the wrong reading. It was a terrible sequence that he embarked on. But there was a kind of politically sophisticated reasoning to it. Sunak had one easy hit he could have made early on, which was to make a great play of integrity. Integrity doesn't cost money. Integrity is not a complex industrial policy. Integrity is about showing that this was going to be a different kind of government. He didn't do that. He brought back Suella Braverman, who uniquely was sacked by Liz Truss for not having high enough standards in the Truss government. And the reason he brought back Suella Braverman was because he felt he was in a politically weak position when he stood for the second time for leadership and wanted her endorsement. But in doing so, immediately blocked off a route of seeming new and fresh. He lacked the imagination and skill to make a clear distance between Johnson and his leadership. And in effect, he didn't do what John Major did, a more supple politician, in 1990 when he replaced Thatcher, when the Tory party was equally traumatized, though not in the state it's in now, where he created a sense of a new start, as if there had been an election and a new government was in place. And he dared, and it was a risk, it infuriated her. He dared to scrap the emblematic policy of her third term government, which had been so unpopular, the poll tax, the local tax. He gave Michael Heseltine, who she loathed, Thatcher, the task of deciding what to do about the poll tax. And of course, he was going to scrap it. He had opposed it all along. And there was a sense of this newness. And Sunak had made no attempt to do that. And the other things that he has been personally responsible for, and this is very much his government, he is taking the key decisions. We don't need to go through really because they've been so well chronicled. But I think again and again at that bizarre party conference, a crucial moment where the whole thing was focusing on whether he was going to scrap HS2, which was going to end in Manchester. And the conference was in Manchester. And everyone knew he was going to scrap it. And yet the whole week he denied he had made a decision or the decision hadn't been taken. So it could be pronounced in the speech. But by then, everyone had known it was coming. And anyway, it was a bizarre decision to take in and to announce in Manchester. And there are so many examples of odd things. That weird address he made outside Number 10 the day after the Rochdale by-election. Largely political. Look, Labour lost that by-election. They lost it to Galloway. Here am I going to take control of Britain, which is becoming increasingly out of control, etc. Actually fueling a problem that was nowhere near as bad as he suggested it was, but with very little to say. So many examples of odd decisions. And of course, famously last week, the delay before condemning the Tory donor for being racist when everybody knew it was racist, etc., etc. So I think in measuring up whether character, context are decisive, I think if I were a Tory MP at this point, I thought it was put very well by the guy I was speaking to at the end of last week. The poll suggests they are heading towards a near-death experience. And so surely you opt for madness. And I don't know whether they will. I've until now thought they wouldn't, that there is no time, that they've got to allow him to lead them into the election, and in any case, there is no one better than him. But I don't think he understands politics. I don't think he understands the country he leads. There are briefings now that they're planning another budget with huge tax cuts to try and force Labour to oppose one of them. And then they have a kind of tax and spend election. And he seems to think that the only thing people are interested in, and maybe this is his background at Goldman Sachs, where all the talk is of, you know, making a killing here, there, transactions, financial transactions, that if you cut taxes enough times, people just vote for you, whatever the state of public services. And, you know, because, and you don't want to personalize it too much, because wealth does not necessarily mean that a leader becomes wholly cocooned from public services falling apart. But that must be part of the explanation, because no one who lived in this country without being cocooned, you know, being able to fly by helicopter and all the rest of it, and would not be able to see that there was a bigger crisis than the amount of money people have earning post-tax, and that's the state of public services. And that can be a Tory issue as much as a Labour issue. And as I've argued before, I think a one-nation Tory leader might be able to take on Labour's caution about saying anything re-tax and spend, and therefore much about public services, could do it. But I mean, it is tough. It is tough because when Sunak says his one pitch to the electorate is, look, I've stabilised the economy, but he stabilised it from the chaos caused by his Tory predecessor. He can't blame that on Labour. So it is really tough. And that would apply to anyone who got it. And by the way, there is no titan waiting in the wings. You know, when Thatcher fell, there was Michael Heseltine, John Major, Douglas Hurd. There were many others who could take over. And there isn't an obvious one. But I did wonder if I was a Tory MP about such is the sort of shallow reporting of elections and politics, and the Tory papers are waiting to have a vehicle to scream for. Maybe some of them will scream for reform in some shape or form, but that's shallow too. I'd be tempted to get rid of him, actually, at this moment, because with poll ratings at 20%, you really are fighting for your life as a political force. And wasn't it only a couple of years ago when us in the cooperative were wondering what it would take for England to move against the Conservative Party? And what it takes is the sort of economic chaos and Partygate and all the other things that have happened, and England have moved. So what do you do? Sit back and accept it, or throw the dice one more time? To my own surprise, having witnessed the utterly pathetic attempts to remove Gordon Brown, the attempts, what else? Yeah, the attempts to sort of destabilise Ed Miliband, which hadn't been properly thought through, the ridiculous coup against Jeremy Corbyn that was never going to succeed. But I kind of think if I were a Tory MP looking at those opinion polls, what lever is available? And there really is only one. Anyway, I leave it hanging in the air, but repeat, this senior Tory thought 55-45, still by no means definite, but more likely than not that they would make a move. Let's see. And while we're waiting, and there are a few questions on this, because you are completely, of course, up to date with everything. But while we wait for more Tory psychodrama which makes Elsinore, Hamlet's Elsinore, seem like a calm and stable place. Let's go to your questions. And if you want to join in our never-ending conversation and debate, it's steverick14@icloud.com. steverick14@icloud.com. Many of you have joined in. I'm going to try and get through as many of these as possible. Paul Langhorn writes that he finds, this is after the discussion I had with Tom Baldwin when we were looking, character is destiny, discuss relation in relation to Keir Starmer. He said, I find Keir Starmer to be fascinating to watch. When was the last prime minister that had done something successfully before politics? Sunak did, Major did, but most come through universities and think tanks. Interesting that what Major, Sunak and Starmer have in common is a lack of a long-developed evangelistic vision. It does tend to make people focus on the practical, it seems. And it's, I think, a huge help on the whole that Keir Starmer has run a big public office. It makes power seem less intimidating. I think for in the New Labour era, including for Tony Blair, who had never been in power, had always been on the opposition benches. Of course, Keir Starmer hasn't been elected power, but he has run a big public office. And that gives some confidence. I remember John Smith, before he died, he had a confidence about governing based on the fact that he had been in a cabinet. He was in the last Labour cabinet briefly. And that does give people a sense of what it's like behind the scenes in power. That's a good thing. I think this thing, oh, Keir Starmer's not political. I think there are some dangers for Keir Starmer in all of that because he is in politics and politics is a vocation. But I think it is to his benefit. Nick Radcliffe from Edinburgh said he really enjoyed the discussion with Tom Baldwin. When you mentioned the possibility of his writing a sequel, this is if Keir Starmer gets in, of course. I mean, the big thing for Keir Starmer is still to happen. It made me reflect that if the consensus is wrong and Starmer doesn't become Prime Minister, a silver lining for me, not Nick, would be what a fantastic and probably long chapter 11 it would make to the prime ministers we never had. Yeah, because he would go right away if he doesn't get it. Blimey, that would be one hell of a chapter. Can you imagine if he loses? That's a book in itself. Anyway, Nick says, reading the book and listening to you talk to Tom has made me slightly more optimistic about what Starmer might be like as a prime minister. Maybe he's a quiet athlete type who'll get a lot done. And maybe, just maybe, he'll still pursue green growth without the £28 billion. That would be something. It would. And it's one of these fascinating things that we just don't know. Now, that is partly the case with all leaders of the opposition on the verge of power. It was quite hard, looking back in 96, early 97, to read what Blair would be like in power. And by the way, those of you who kindly subscribe to the Patreon version of Rock and Roll Politics, you will have got the bonus podcast based around an interview I did with Tony Blair in July 1996. And I think that shows how hard it was then to read what Blair was going to do with power. He didn't wholly know himself. And certainly that applies to Keir Starmer too. So it could be, Nick, that he is an aptly reformer although I wonder, he's clearly not going to go at the speed of that 45 government, who by 1948 had established the National Health Service and built many, many houses and reformed welfare on the sort of Beveridge principles, and had, they had to do it all in the context of economic fragility like now. But I don't think he's going to move quite as fast as that. He's said as much. Thanks, Nick. Sean Farrell. Starmer agreed to a ghosted autobiography and then sensibly changed his mind. He was originally going to do it in his name. Keir was going to do, but decided against it. And there's an interesting question from Sean. Has any leader of the opposition attempted to write an autobiography before? I can't think of one. I can't either. Tony Blair published an anthology of his speeches, which came out just before the 97 election. There are always quick biographies of leaders who might win, but I can't think of anyone who would have attempted a memoir. Can any of you? I can't think of one. So it would have been an unusual thing to do, and he was probably right not to pursue it. James Gill, I understand the instinctive caution of Starmer and Reeves. From a consumer voter perspective, it's always better to undersell and over-deliver. But might they want to convey a new big idea through a new national story to lead a national recovery? This thing of under-promising and over-delivering was another kind of New Labour thought in the build-up to 97. And it certainly applied in that case. That incremental manifesto in 97 was then in power, swamped by bigger things, sure start, finally investing in the NHS up to EU levels. That was in the second term, though, et cetera, et cetera. But I agree with you that such is the state we're in at the moment. Kind of, Keir Starmer has said it. It's like the challenges of 45, 64 and 97 crammed into one. Well, if you're serious about that, it needs a big idea to guide people through. And I think Britain is in as kind of broken a state as 45, actually. And it's going to need big, big thoughts. By the time you've heard this, or most of you will have heard it, Rachel Reeves will have delivered the Mays Lecture, which is a big moment for a shadow chancellor. I'm going to read it very carefully and might reflect on it next week, depending on what's happening. Because the art of opposition and governing is to link policies to values, to promote those policies so they are accepted or enthused about, but have a driving sense of purpose. And I'm a fan of a big idea in politics, as long as it's then related to policy development and isn't a fantasy like the 2019 election, get Brexit done, levelling up. They're both big ideas, but hadn't been thought through for more than about 5 seconds. James says he subscribes to Patreon and he's got his rock and roll politics mug. Many a cup of consequences will be enjoyed from it. You see, if you subscribe to Patreon, you get a rock and roll politics mug. You get these bonus podcasts. Please subscribe. Thank you, James. Fraser Oates is surprised that Sunak didn't go for the May general election. Others were as well. Jeff, our Irish correspondent, who is sometimes also in Crouch End, was absolutely convinced he was going to go for May. Do you think he can survive his MPs for long after the expected bad results in the local elections? Well, that, Fraser, is the question I've been kind of reflecting on in the podcast. For the first time, I have my doubts whether he can. Patrick Martin with a related issue. Who would want to take over as PM at this point? Even if someone did, would anyone want to be PM for just 4 to 7 months tops? 62 Tory MPs are leaving at the election. Is it right that such a large number should have a say as to who their next leader is when they've effectively resigned from post before the general election takes place? Good point. Really good point. They have no direct investment in the future of the parliamentary party because they won't be part of it. I hadn't thought of that. Patrick's got good. If I were advising the Tory party, I would advise the following. Let Rishi remain as prime minister until the election, but elect a new leader to campaign to take them into the next election and beyond. Relax their rules to allow a non-MP to become leader. I assume you mean David Cameron temporarily, do you? I don't know. It's one of the kind of, it shows the febrile state of it. This won't happen. And you can't do that either, Patrick. You can't kind of have another leader at the election. And they've got to decide that near-death experience or madness juxtaposition. But it's a good point about those MPs who've declared they're going. They will be players if there is a removal of Sunak, and yet they're going. Very good point. John from Aberdeen wonders about his last name withheld because he's always worried he's going to be suspended from the Labour Party, or purged, as he puts it. And he is suspicious of the Starmer withdrawing the whip from Diane Abbott for over a year with no proper investigation, or with a bizarrely long investigation, with, he says, the sole intention of deselecting her as an MP. And Starmer used the abhorrent racist abuse she has faced to score political points in recent days, even though neither he nor any member of the Shadow Cabinet bothered to get in touch with her. Although he did, he spoke to her, of course, immediately after Prime Minister's questions, when disgracefully she wasn't called. Lindsay Hoyle has got a lot to answer for not calling her. And Keir Starmer went up and had a talk. And of course, when he said, "What could I do to help?" she said, "Give me the whip back." And I think we all know what they're doing by this investigation carrying on and on and on. And it is interesting now that Diane Abbott has become an unlikely figure who is popular with the media across the kind of spectrum, almost, in the sense that the abuse she has had to endure horrifies anyone who is remotely human in politics. And so it's become a bit harder, I think, for those who had just planned to let this thing go on until the election and then put someone in her very safe seat, to do so away from the spotlight of the political stage. But anyway, John, you won't be purged. You've kept yourself anonymous-ish. Andrew Stewart from Sheffield. During my adult life, I've seen public utilities sold off, building societies transferred from members to shareholders, and many football clubs owned by people and businesses to become detached from supporters. And now, is politics going the same way? The Conservatives are no longer a mass membership organisation. Hester, the big donor, and others like him are an important part of that interest group, and that's why the reaction to his racism was awkward for Sunak and others. He's a donor, but to all intents and purposes, he's effectively a shareholder in the Tory party. And he mentions the Labour Party is more complex because its structures are archaic, bureaucratic and sclerotic. It is true, actually, the way you're right about it. And both major parties are in many ways dysfunctional. But I have a sense that trade union influence is less than opponents suggest, though not absent. I don't think any of this is a good thing. And in fact, the direction of travel is very dangerous. What do you think? Well, I agree with you about the lack of accountability now with the transfer of ownership. And it's an interesting point about political parties, that they are, in effect, the big donors are kind of shareholders. Of course, the unions are formerly part of the Labour Party. These big, wealthy, multi-million donations to the Tory party are something different from that. Labour, too, will have them from businesses. And it's partly about the way you do politics. And the alternative to these big donations is state funding. And I personally think that's a better way forward. It would take all of this out of politics. But of course, it has its problems too. But I would back state funding. But I know you make a wider point, Andrew. Now, driver Andy, white van man, the cooperative's white van driver Andy has written about many things. He's coming live to King's Place next week. I'm looking forward to meeting him in real life. Now, this is interesting. is the right rising in Europe? Andy is the cooperative's close observer of Reform, who he thinks is going to do really well, dangerously well, at the British general election, including in Labour seats too. Anyway, and he hangs out with people who are big fans of Reform, and he tells us, you know, we might live in different worlds, but this is a world we need to be aware of. Anyway, he said, I'm struck by the rapidity with which the far-right Portuguese party, Chega, turned around a projected 5% voter share in the faraway days of November to a near 20% and potential balance of power it achieved this month. I know I'm boring on about this, but it reinforces my view that with a wily campaigner like Farage at the reins, Reform could achieve somewhere around 20% of the election. I remain the cooperative's white van man with his ears wide open in the loading bays and snugs of the red brick Midlands. Yeah, well, thank you for that, Andy. Now, this is what's really interesting, because we have one of our members in Portugal. Daniel Trump writes, something different from Andy. The media has portrayed the vote for Chega, 20%, as representative of the surge of the populist right across Europe. Whilst the vote for Chega is significant, it's not quite so clearly a vote for right-wing populism as described in the media. It's more a vote of frustration with the economic policies of PS and PSD. The last 10 years of PS, the socialist rule, have more in common with a centre-right party in the UK, something like Cameron's government, than with a socialist government. There's been industrial action across most public sectors due to underfunding. Many of those Chega votes are for improved public services and housing rather than a GB News type of anti-immigration, anti-woke stance. It's certainly a vote against corruption. It doesn't have the same value basis as a vote for Reform in the UK or a vote for Trump in the US. So there we are, two very different views on the outcome of the Portuguese election. Over now to Helen B. I've just listened to your interview with Tom Baldwin and found it fascinating. I haven't read his book, but when I looked it up to check out the price, I saw there was another book about Keir Starmer called The Starmer Project. I wondered if any of you had listened to it and how they compare. My husband, myself and my son all enjoy your deep dives. Oh, thank you, Helen. And yeah, to be honest, I think I've read it. I'm not wholly sure. But I think I have. And if it's the one I read, it's much more critical than the Baldwin book. I think the Baldwin book is a really good book. And he's managed something very tricky to pull off, which is to be close and sympathetic to the subject at a crucial pivotal moment in that subject's life and career. The edge probably of being prime minister. Some of you did think it bought it after hearing the interview and thought it is hagiographic. I don't think it is. But the other one, I think, is much more critical. Thank you, Helen. Over to our French correspondent, Dominique Jewell, who dares to raise the issue of Brexit, which, of course, is taboo in the United Kingdom. And she just says that while France undoubtedly has its own problems, there are no hospital waiting lists, GP appointments are readily available, transport systems work. I've yet to come across a pothole. Social care is provided as necessary. Bins are emptied weekly. And those few food banks which do exist are an addition to the functioning social security system, not an integral part of it. I could go on. And she wonders the degree to which Brexit has played a significant role in the decline in the UK and why there is a conspiracy of silence on the matter from all quarters. Dominica, it is. I mean, a lot of the problems were there pre-2016, but have deepened considerably since then. And it is a weird world where it is hardly mentioned. And it's one of these things that happens behind the radar, you know, firms struggling to export. It's very hard to get parts. I was trying to order a kind of really good bike lock that a friend of mine's got. Oh, I must get that bike lock. And you can't get it. You go on the website and they deliver across the EU, but not to the UK. It's too expensive to bring the stuff in. It's a disaster. And there are some who think this mission for growth at the heart of the Starmer government, number one mission, can only be done when Britain gets back into the customs union and the single market. So thank you very much from France. Now, God, how long have we been going for? Yeah, 47 minutes plus. So I'm going to kind of draw it to a close. If you're running, step on it, because we're going to be finishing quite shortly. Thank you to Simon Lockyer, who predicts with me an autumn election is most likely. He's not convinced about a Labour landslide. He wonders whether, a bit like White Van Man Andy, that Reform could take votes from Labour in the Red Wall, and Labour supporters in some cases may stay at home. And he wonders whether this could mean that the polls have got it drastically wrong. Alex Bell in Switzerland, I'm a marketeer by profession, and it requires, when you're marketing things, a synthesis of storytelling and numerical analysis. And he gives me examples of what would make a good politician in that context. And the two tasks, once getting elected to obtain power, using elected power effectively and wisely in the service of a vision. It's the second, which is at least as challenging as the first, Alex. If you get my book on prime ministers, I outline in the introduction the qualifications for leadership as I see it. And you've summarised some of them very well. Venetia Kane wonders about focusing on the cuts in local authority budgets and whether in the end it is partly an ideological thing. I don't think it's so much ideological, Venetia, as from the very beginning of this long period of rule from 2010, it's an easy cut for central government to make because they don't appear to get the blame for it directly. But again, I don't think that's true anymore. I think what voters just see is decline in the so-called public realm at all levels and look to form an anti-Tory mood as a result. And that's why things like cuts in national insurance don't change the situation. Rob Roy from France, bien à vous, Rob, wonders about the impact of political cartoons on the subjects who are made into the cartoons. Huge, Rob. They reflect on it in all cases, I think. Joe Farrington Douglas writes a very good retort, amongst other things, to my podcast wondering whether Liz Truss had a point when she was viewed with utter disdain about where power lies in Britain. He says on Liz Truss, she wasn't prevented from doing anything at all. She was elected on the 2019 Manifesto for Economic Interventionism, but passed a budget in the opposite direction without a mandate. Nobody could or did stop her. Then the markets reacted. That's a good point, actually. And it's a point I'm going to come back to. You know, the whole basis on which British politics works is a mandate from the electorate. And we need to look at that 2019 mandate in some detail and the degree to which it's worth getting it out and reading. Now, I know few voters read the manifestos in advance, but it's on the basis that all this current lot, including Rishi Sunak, were elected. Plan for social care to be delivered, amongst many other things, hospitals to be built, levelling up to happen. Let's have a look at that mandate and the degree to which the means of delivery had never been thought through when it was published. And as I say, you know, the hurdles, I mean, Labour are too cautious and lack almost language to put a case. But the hurdles placed in front of a potential Labour government in an election compared with that 2019 manifesto, or indeed 2010, when David Cameron almost won and ended up as Prime Minister. But another time, and thank you for the brilliant point and the other points you made. Thank you, all of you. As loads of emails. We've read quite a few out in this question time session. Hope to see a lot of you at King's Place on March 26th, where we will be delving deep together. Glass or two of wine, perhaps, and some fun as well. We've got to have a laugh in these weird, weird, dark times. Thank you very much. It's going to be another busy week. Rwanda. Take a look at Rachel Reeves' May lecture and other things too. And with that background hum of, would the Tory MPs move again? Another Prime Minister? Epic times. I need to lie down. All of us, go and have a lie down. And we'll see you again very soon. Thank you very much, I say, on Patreon. Hope you enjoy the Tony Blair reflections as he prepared for power and the comparisons with now. And keep the questions coming in our never-ending discussion. Thanks so much. Take care. Bye.